UK Wine Show, show number 73. Neil Martin on wine ratings. G'day. Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 73 for the 19th of October, 2007. My name's Chris Scott, and this week we're going to be talking with wine writer Neil Martin. Neil has been rating wines for a number of years now, using a 20-point system, but recently had to change when his new employer, Robert Parker, the famous American wine critic, Robert uses a 100-point system, and Neil's had to adapt from his current system to the new one. We're going to be talking about Neil, about wine ratings, what they mean to him, and what they mean to his readers. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. Coming up this week, wine from Namibia and Australian wine tops international wine competition. But first, American scientists have invented two scanning devices that can detect cork taint and oxidation in wines without having to open the bottles. These could, in theory, end the risk involved in wine investing, because even very old bottles can be checked to ensure the wine inside isn't spoiled. The two scanners are able to check the chemical composition of a wine by operating on nuclear magnetic resonance. A collector from New Jersey who has a cellar of 75,000 bottles saw the potential of the device and set up a company called Wine Scanner Inc. The plan is to offer a scanning service where people can go to have bottles tested. At the moment, it costs $50 to have one bottle certified, so the market is limited to collectors of rare wines. But it's a small price to pay when thousands of pounds are at stake. Next up, a British-born businessman is successfully making top-quality wine from grapes grown in the desert. Alan Walkden Davis has planted Shiraz and Merlot in Namibia, just a few miles from the Namib Desert at 24 degrees latitude. An amazing feat given that most grapes grow between 30 and 50 degrees. He produces 3,000 to 3,500 bottles a year with the help of irrigation and cool nights. The average rainfall is just 3 inches annually, and 5 springs provide all the water needed for irrigating the vineyards. Apparently, the cool nights from November to January are critical to the quality of the grapes, and mountains shield the vines from the harsh winds to create a near-perfect terroir. The 2004 Namib Red is described by Cape wine critic Michael Oliver as stunning, with nice dark berries, slight acidity and a little bit of peppery Italian leather. Would love to have a taste. Finally, Australia has been given a massive vote of confidence at this year's International Wine and Spirit Competition by being awarded a third of all the gold medals. The country cleaned up with 38 best-in-class golds as well as another 6 gold medals. It wasn't all good news, though. South Africa managed to outdo them on the grapes they're best known for by winning a trophy for the world's best Shiraz and another for the top Chardonnay. For more details of the award-winning wines, you can visit our website 3050.co.uk or for a full list, go to iwsc.net. That's all this week, but 40 years ago, in October 1967, there was a revolution in a Bordeaux vat room with new stainless steel fermenting tanks installed at Château Latour. Their neighbour, Chateau Mouton Rothschild, dismissed the technology, saying it would be another 70 or 80 years before they considered alternatives to oak. Remember, you can get more detail on these news stories on our news homepage at 3050.co.uk. That's it from me. Back over to you, Chris.
Cheers, Jane. I quite like the idea of scanners, but they are a bit of an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. You'd think that if a winery is selling wine for 100 or thousands of pounds a bottle, you'd at least ensure that the wine isn't corked before it was sold. For top-end wineries, that'd be a great way of improving the average quality of their wines quickly and easily by just simply checking to make sure they're not faulty. That said, a winery selling wines that are really expensive will use very, very high-quality cork with very, very low cork taint rates. But if it's a cheaper winery, they tend to use cheaper cork with higher cork taint rates. This is a financial decision that the producers make when choosing a lower cork but cheaper. And I think it's for this reason that we need to make sure that we send back any wine that is corked. If they get the feedback and it starts costing them more money, then perhaps they'll actually go for higher quality corks in the end. The oxidation detection, I think, is also quite important, particularly for the wines closed in cork. If the wine's not kept in good condition, normally on its side to keep the cork moist, it'll dry out and allow lots of oxygen through. So the oxidation method at least checks for poor storage conditions. The other thing that was sort of interest was the wine from Namibia. At 24 degrees is a fair way off normal 30 to 50 degree latitude that most wines typically grow in. But that said, I tried a wine this week from Brazil, from Waitrose, called Rio Sol 2005 Val de Sao Francisco. It's reportedly grown at 8 degrees latitude, which is pretty much on the equator. I tried it. I thought it was pretty good, and it sells for under a fiver at Waitrose. So if you want to see what a really hot climate wine is like, try one there. It was surprisingly good, and it was a wee bit jammy, but it was nice. Definitely worth looking at if you're into higher latitude wines in strange places. Next up, we have the interview with Neil Martin. This week's podcast is a bit longer than normal, as the interview is fairly long. If you like the length, or you don't like the length, just give us a call. I'd love to hear whether you like it or not. We've had a few requests for slightly longer shows recently, so I thought I'd just try this out and see how you go. If you want to send me feedback on that, my email address is chris.scott@ukwineshow.co.uk. That's chris.scott@ukwineshow.co.uk. Last week's show went up very late. Sorry about that. It's due to a change on our servers. We have had an upgrade to our servers, and as a result, we had a few technical glitches which stopped the show going out. Hopefully, service has been restored to normal. Let's have a listen to the show. Hi, I'm here with Neil Martin from erobertparkers.com.
Yep.
Wine writer, not blogger anymore.
No.
And we're going to be talking about wine ratings.
Okay.
Wine ratings, quite a contentious issue in the wine industry in terms of, you know, particularly Robert, he's got a lot of power with his scoring. Mm-hmm. But there's lots of different scoring systems about.
Sure.
Do you want to tell us a bit about why you score wines?
I score wines because I think at the end of the day, if you're a wine writer, I'm not writing for myself, I'm writing for an audience. And so I write according to what they want. And although I think a lot of wine writers dislike scores, most people that buy wine like them because, for me, they are part of the tasting note and they're like the kind of the full stop at the end. I think the advantage of having a score is that it's more objective than having, say, a metaphor. Mm-hmm. Or like very good. I mean, how do you interpret very good? You know, it can be different to different people.
Sure.
Whereas at least a score applies a little bit of objectivity in what is a very subjective field. Yeah.
Okay. How do you work out your ratings?
Actually, I'm not one of these people that give, you know, marks out of 10 for colour and 20 for nose. And I think a lot of it is instinct. I think it's a little bit like if you see a member of the opposite sex, you kind of know whether they're good looking or not.
Yeah. You don't give them a point for having green eyes.
No, you just think, oh, well, she's a...
honey.
Or she's an 88, or she's a... You know,
yeah.
Like that. But if you ask someone to do that, you could probably do it.
Yeah.
And in the same way with wines, when it's almost an instant kind of thing. It's like...
I think it's actually a really good example, isn't it?
Well, the example I use is because I used to study management when I was at university. It was useless. But the one thing I do remember was that, and it's you read it elsewhere, is that people make a decision upon the interviewee almost as soon as they walk in the door. And I think that's the same with wine, is that when I nose it and when I taste it, there's already that number in my head. It's just an instant reaction, and then what I'm looking for is, okay, just to back that number up, does it need to go up or down? But it's kind of like an instant process. But I mean, you have to remember that, you know, you're not tasting like 5 or 6 wines leisurely over a day. You know, I might have 100 wines to do, so you can't be too kind of sit and reflect upon each wine. You've got to be fairly, what's the word, mechanical about it? Or
yeah. Process, going through a process.
Yeah.
When you taste the wines, do you do them blind?
It depends on the situation. I mean, London's a fantastic... London's the best city in the world for tasting wine, without question. There's tastings here than anywhere else in the world, and really amazing tastings that I'm very lucky to attend. And so it depends on the organisers whether they do it blind or not. Mm-hmm. But, for example, you mentioned the Quinta de Vargas tasting. I mean, if you're invited to taste, 15 different vintages, then you're not going to refuse it because it's not blind.
Yeah.
You know. And I think hopefully one of the things as a critic is that I'm not influenced by the label at all. And I think partly because when I first started tasting wines and marking them for myself, I was lucky in that I started at the top. So rather than sort of starting at, say, a supermarket wine and having your epiphany with Latour 3 or 4 years later, I kind of started with Monrose, Latour and Henri Jaillet, and they gave me a very good kind of benchmark of what wine can achieve. And so it gave me quite a good understanding of how different wines should be marked.
I noticed on here that I read some of your tasting notes a wee while ago, and you're doing a tasting of Chateau Palmer a wee while mm-hmm. ago, and you said in there that the very classic on the nose, cigar box, cedar, palate very closed, rather austere. So you thought it was maybe a 96 rather than mm-hmm. 2000, which was a reasonably good year. You tasted it blind and awarded it a 90 out of 100. But once you identified and revealed what it was, you realised it was a sulking adolescent period, slamming bedroom doors and complaining to the parents that doesn't understand it. And do you think once you knew the wine, you maybe rated it slightly differently to the way that you would have before you knew it?
Yeah, I think context is a very important thing. I mean, I love blind tasting. I think you learn a lot about the wine without the label, and it's very useful for kind of judging wines without the kind of sort of kudos and the hoopla around it. But at the same time, wines do go through different phases. Some close down, and sometimes when a wine is revealed, you understand more about where your note was coming from, so you can qualify that a bit more and say, well, now I can see, given that it was this vintage or it was this chateau, then I can understand why it wasn't performing well. And that comes from a kind of experience, because if you've tasted like many vintages, you can see the kind of evolution. It's not just a smooth kind of,
Wines don't steadily get better.
Yeah, they perform different on different occasions and different settings. And I try and relate that honestly, So I'm not kind of, if I give, a score, I don't feel that, okay, from now on, it has to be that score. Because I think wines do vary according to the...
So are you judging the wine as it appears in the glass now, or how you think the overall wine will perform over its lifetime?
I think that the two are intimately connected. So you look at... And that's when the identity of the wine is quite important. Because I think when I'm tasting a wine, with the knowledge of how that wine performs over a period of time will kind of qualify how you're tasting that wine now. So you can say, oh yeah, it's going to be in a closed stage, or and that just comes from experience of just tasting and tasting again.
There's a wine book in the US called the Wine Blue Book, and they take ratings from a number of critics and come up with an average and then try and show the price versus that average rating. It's very, very, it's almost geared towards traders in that, if a wine's underperforming based on its ratings, then it's, buy it and sell higher sort of attitude. Do you think that's a good idea?
No, I mean, that's kind of, in giving us a score, I mean, critiquing a wine is completely separate to how wine is bought and sold. And from what you're saying, that blue book is not a book designed for somebody who wants to, say, learn about, for example, we said Chateau Palmer. They're not going to learn anything about the chateau from that. It's just mathematics and economics, isn't it? Mm. So you can't prevent a book like that being written, just like you can't stop people investing in wine and making the prices go up. I mean, that's economics, that's life. So you just have to get on with it, you know. But I mean, what I do is try and an effort into writing about the wines, so that you just don't, I don't have just the scores or the notes hanging in the air, but it would be within the context of an article. And what I try and do is like information of where that wine was tasted, or how was the weather, or where did the bottles come from, or what order did they come in, you know, things like that, so that you know where I was at the time. And I think that's really important. And it's not done, for me, it's not done enough in wine writing.
Yeah, I think you summed it up quite nicely when you said the rating's like the full stop at the end, yeah, rather than maybe the whole article.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if I write a 3,000, 4,000 word article, then the scores will only be, there might be like a dozen numbers in there. Yeah. So,
I thought it was quite interesting talking about that the wine blue book.
I haven't heard of that, by the way.
I haven't read it myself, but right. I've heard about it through a few bits and pieces. There was a thing called there was a wee article I read on the web. I'm not sure which website I got it off, but it was about a wine that you rated and you proclaimed it. It was a 1982
Le Conscient. Oh yeah, Le Conscient.
And you thought it was the, according to them, the second coming, and was had the market in a complete tizzy, and a trader who was buying it, you know, landed up having all these calls from people trying to get hold of the wine. They're all desperate because they thought, fantastic, this is going to be a great wine. And so people were ringing up and they'd done all these deals and got it already. And then Robert Parker himself comes out and gives it a 93. And all of a sudden, these people who thought the wine was fantastic and wanted it desperately suddenly didn't really want it. 93 is still a good rating. Do you think that sort of hysteria that gets evolved from the rating system is a good thing?
Well, I think it's like, you know, I mean, for years we've had people saying that, oh, Robert Parker's a dictator. And so, you know, he's made, you know, I think a great decision to employ not just myself but other writers to give an alternative opinion. So that kind of what you've just said is kind of predictable in a way that, okay, it's nice that people are kind of following my scores, you know, that's a compliment. And if they suddenly decide, Robert Parker doesn't on this occasion, because remember, we're only talking about, he's probably tasted it far more times than I have. When Robert Parker had it soon afterwards, he was, what did he give it, 93. So he's only probably, he's not much, I rated it a little bit higher, but not there's not that much degree of difference. And if they want to suddenly cancel their orders based on that, well, you know, that's their decision. Mm. But all I can say is I can remember tasting that wine just before Christmas, and it was absolutely fantastic. And
bottle variation?
There's always going to be some variation between different bottles. I mean, I could open a bottle this afternoon and find, oh, it's not quite as nice as before.
Yeah.
But I think I think that's where the internet's really good, in that if you're writing a book, then you've got something in print that will say, this Le Conscient is, okay, for example, 93. Whereas on the internet, because you're not limited by space, you can taste it in at different times, different locations, different formats, and create a more kind of, I think, three-dimensional tasting note. So you can say, I tasted out of barrel and it was like this, and after bottling it was like that. And I had it from a négociant and it tasted like this. And then a friend brought it around from dinner and it was like that. And so I always think it's like if you have a house, you can look at it from the front, but you also want to look at it, you know, from the back and the sides and above and inside. So I think the internet's a great, you know, you can have a tasting that looks at it different angles. So that's going to be confusing for people that dogmatically follow scores, but I think it's also a more honest reflection on wine.
This use of the units of out of 100, in actual fact, it's not really out of 100 anyway, it's 50 to 100, isn't it? You don't really go below 50.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that, you know, wine, some people say that if the wine gets an 89, it's considered, you know, good wine, but not fantastic. But one mark gets it to 90, and all of a sudden the demand shoots up for it.
Mm.
Do you think that you can actually taste wine to a resolution of 1%. Or 89 versus 90.
Obviously, it's not 1%.
It's 2%.
But it's not even 2%, because I think that there's a kind of a level of wines where there's a point where we think, I'm going to recommend this wine. And I think usually it's above 80 points. So that means you've got a 20-point scale between 80 and 100, which is no different to somebody marking out for 20 and using 0.5s. Mm-hmm. There's that same sort of calibration. It's about 20 points. 20 kind of...
resolution.
A resolution of, say, 20. And I think that's kind of reasonable. That's a reasonable kind of... I think as a taster, you should be able to gorge between a wine that you would recommend from the lowest going 0 up to the greatest wine in the world ever, 100 or 20.
Yeah.
So I think actually, although people kind of always comparing, you know, the 20-point system or the 100-point system, actually they're very similar, very, very similar.
In our tastings, we use a rating system of 1 to 5. 1 is yuck, 5 is fantastic.
Yeah.
And what we find is that when you give people, the wine, like one of the wines we're tasting a lot at the moment is a 20-year-old Sherry, nice wee PX. And you get as many people who hate the wine as think it's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
When you give a wine a rating, that doesn't necessarily reflect what someone else would think about that wine. Do you taste the wines to your palate, or do you taste the wines to what you think the consumer likes?
I think the sort of cardinal rule is you have to taste for yourself. I mean, when I wrote my first ever note on my Excel spreadsheet 10 years ago, that was for myself. And then thereafter, the notes have always been for myself, whether it's me just back in my little office just as a reminder of that wine, or now when the notes are being, you know, put on Robert Parker's website and having thousands of people read them. But it doesn't change the kind of raison d'etre of that tasting note. It's kind of for myself. And if that tasting note resonates with other people, and if their palates calibrate similar to mine, then you're going to have like a following. And if you don't, then that's no problem. You just have an individual taste, and of course people will always, you know, there'll be somebody, for example, I don't like sherry. I wouldn't even do a sherry tasting. For some reason I just hate it. And so yeah. And I know people say to me, oh, you know, you should get into sherry, and I said, I'd love to get into sherry, but the nuts and bolts of it, I just don't like it.
Do you think you'd rate that quite low then?
I wouldn't even rate it. Because it's not fair, because that's, I know that's a personal thing. I know there's great sherries in the world, and, you know, I'm aware of my limitations in that I don't like sherry. So I leave that to someone else.
Okay, fair enough.
But I think you have to taste for yourself, and if you have a palate which other people can relate to, then, you know, people will follow your judgment.
Do you think, when you're tasting a wine... sometimes wines can have what can be perceived as fault. Like some wines have a bit of Brett, some wines might be quite reductive in their nature. The rating system sort of has a section saying the wine is faulty. You know, I think it's 50 to 59, wine unacceptable. But sometimes faults are very subjective, you know.
Well, I think if a wine is faulty, it won't get rated. Certainly with me, I just put a question mark. I think there's something wrong with this wine. I think if a wine gets between 50 and 59, it's just not a very good wine. So, but if it's faulty, certainly with me, like I'm writing up Burgundy 2005s at the moment. So if I have a barrel sample and it's just not showing, or I just know there's something not quite right with this, then I'll usually just put a question mark. Or sometimes I'll put, look, I think it's this score, but I'll put a question mark. And in the note, I will put, okay, I'm going to try and taste this again. But, you know, so again, you have to just be transparent and just say, look, this wine is not showing well, or is completely faulty.
But if the wine does have some reductive notes to it, or a bit of Brett or something like that, where do you draw the line and say, oh, this is part of the character of the wine, or this is... a fault?
Yeah, I mean, well, at the end of the day, you know, wine is subjective. Some people love Brett. Some people run a million miles away from it. So, again, you just have to be transparent and just say, this is far too much Brett that's detrimental to the wine. Or this Brett is quite subtle and complements and compliments the wine, and you just have to go out and say that.
What's the lowest ranking you've ever given a wine?
I've given like surreal rankings. I think there was one, I think there's a one wine, I think I gave it 12 out of 100, even though it doesn't go, it goes down to 50, but I just did that because it was just so horrible. But the lowest mark, I mean, it's kind of difficult because I've only just started marking
out of
100, but I've, you know, I've given a few 60s and 70s recently. Mm-hmm. But generally that's for Wine Journal.
Yeah.
You have to distinguish between Wine Journal and Wine Advocate. So with Wine Advocate, we don't put scores below, I think it's 85. Whereas with Wine Journal, I just put everything up and, you know, take the consequences.
I noticed, I had a look at the scale that that you use on the Wine Advocate, and it sort of describes it. 50 to 59 is unacceptable. 60 to 69 is below average with noticeable deficiencies.
Mm-hmm.
70 to 79, average, with a little distinction, maybe, but well made. 80 to 89, barely above average, but very good. 1995, outstanding, and 96 to 100 is extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
Given that the average is 70 to 79, I'd sort of expect half the wines to be below, say, 75, and half the wines to be above 75 to get that average. But you never really see them.
But I think there's a difference because if you look at, say, the Wine Advocate or Wine Journal, that generally focuses on the higher end of the wine spectrum. So you're going to tend to get a higher average score than if, say, I went to taste a more sort of general tasting. So, I mean, for the Wine Advocate, they're kind of, originally before the website, they were limited to what you could put into print. So logically, you would focus on the great wines that you want to recommend, and anything that gets below that score, you just have to leave out. And that's still the same case. I mean, I've still got a lot of tasting notes that haven't gone up, but just they weren't good tastings, and you know, they just haven't gone up.
I don't want to bang on this too much, but you know, if 60 to 69 is below average, and this is the definition of it, wine containing noticeable deficiencies such as excessive acidity, or tannins, absence of flavour, or possibly dirty aromas of flavours. You go to the supermarket now, and it's very hard to find a wine like that. You know, there are very few wines that are poorly made. So everything would be average or better now. So the ratings, I find this quite difficult to get my head around.
But then again, you're saying that you'd go to a supermarket. So most supermarkets would have a kind of a wine department that would have filtered out.
But they sell 90% of the wine. So of the wines on the market,
yeah,
they may have been filled out, but they just didn't get here.
Yeah, but if you went to say, if you're going to do a random trip around, you know, France or Spain.
I've had some terrible Chinese wine recently.
Yeah, but you don't have to go that far. I mean, you can go to if you go to France and just pop in, you know, random cooperatives. You know, there's a lot of terrible wine that would warrant those marks. Yeah. And if we had lots of space, then you could type them all up and say, well, this is a...
Don't drink this.
Don't drink this, 63 points, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know...
If you're a winery, what sort of person do you think submits their wines for ratings? Are they always big wineries trying to shift a lot of stock? Are they small niche players?
To me, they don't submit wines to me. I never get any samples.
You don't?
No.
You must be one of the few wineries.
Never get... I know, it's kind of ironic, really, because... I'm not saying I'm the most powerful wine writer in the world, but I probably have some influence. But I never get any samples sent to me. I think partly is because I've come up through the kind of the internet side of things, and you know, wineries are kind of a bit slow to catch on that actually the internet is a very powerful tool, and the people that recommend wines on it, you know, do have a great degree of influence, you know. So so now I don't get any samples, but I don't kind of, in some ways I don't need them because I go to so many tastings. I have more than enough to write about. So I'm probably glad I don't, in a way.
Okay.
But I buy a lot of wines that I rate, so I just go down and buy them.
I suppose one of the advantages of the internet for rating wines and ranking wines is that if you write a blog about a wine, it's still available because it's only probably a couple of days older. There's always this thing about, you know, getting a wine book, finding the, you know, the 5-10 wines you think you want to get, finding them and finding out they got sold 6 months before the book was even published. Do you think that's a valid point with some rank?
Yeah, I think so. I think the market is, I mean, you know, I worked as a wine buyer for 10 years, so I know exactly how it works. And, you know, nowadays, as soon as an opinion or a score goes on the internet, the market moves, you know, within, you could say not even hours, but minutes. You know, especially if you've got a wine produced in small quantities, you know, it will just go. And that's just the internet, not just for wine, but for anything.
We talked about the sort of wines you like, you know, Bordeaux, you're a big French man, high-end French man.
Yeah.
But what sort of wines do you actually prefer?
What, to drink at home?
Yeah, yeah, because obviously you rate the wines based on what you like.
Yeah.
So what wines do you like? So we can sort of work out.
You see, I can't afford any of the wines I rate because they're so expensive. So I don't. At home, I'm just like everyone else. I drink. I actually, I'm lucky. I live near to Cave de Pirenne down the road, so I go down there, and I'll buy kind of wines at, you know, £5, £6, £7. You know, just like everybody else, their wines just to drink, and if there's something interesting, then I'll write about it. But their wines to drink, and then if I want something, if I go to like an offline or something like that, we have to bring a bottle. Then I'll bring something. I'll be either. I think my drinking habit is either I'll drink something that's £5, or I'll open a bottle of Petrus. One or the other, and I've got no problem with opening something really, really expensive. Absolutely none at all. And I've had a few people sort of come round and sort of quite amazed at what I've opened, but I just view them as wine, so
yeah.
They're there to be, you know, enjoyed. And so, well, you know, let's just open it.
What about styles of wines?
I like kind of elegant wines.
When you say elegant, do you mean wines with crisp acidity?
Yeah, I like wines with crisp acidity. I don't mind a little bit of underripeness. I know other people don't like it, and that's fine. But for me, I think it adds a little bit of freshness to a wine. I'm not so keen on the very high alcohol wines. Personally, I get terrible headaches and hangovers.
I'm the same. Drink a high alcohol, 3 or 4 bottles of high alcohol wine next day.
Yeah, that's right. But at the same time, I've had a lot of wines where I've thought, wow, that's a beautiful wine. That's really elegant, a lot of finesse. And I look at it and it's got like 14.5% alcohol. So you can't sort of, I think the trouble is people sort of generalize too much and they say, well, anything over 14% is no good. Mm. But actually, there's a lot of wonderfully made wines in that style. So you have to be, you've got to remain open-minded.
Your boss is well known for liking big alcoholic extracted wines.
I think, that's always kind of bandied around, but kind of people forget that he also, for example, loves German wines. And a lot of people kind of focus on, okay, where he's rated, like a wine that has very high alcohol. But I think actually, if you look at most wine writers, they also rate the same wines very high. Even the ones that kind of claim that have this kind of agenda that, okay, we're anti-blockbusters. And then actually you find that they do the same thing as he does, except he seems to get a lot of flack for it. But
okay, I think we'll just wrap up with a wee quote from Jancis. Mm-hmm. This is something I found on their website a wee while ago.
Is this about me looking vague or something?
No, it's nothing dirty, mate. she sort of says, I'm not a great fan of the conjunction of numbers and wine. Once numbers are involved, it's all too easy to reduce wine to a financial commodity, reduce wine to a financial commodity rather than keep its precious status as a uniquely stimulating source of sensual pleasure and conviviality.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's quite a nice way to say it. Finish off on.
Yeah, but they did the same thing in the 19th century. So, you know, it's like saying, oh, well, we shouldn't rank all the Bordeaux according to Premier Cru.
Yeah, true. You know. Okay, we'll wrap it up then, Neil.
Yeah, I'd give this interview an I give you a 90 just to give it so people will listen. So.
90, that's extraordinary. No, outstanding, sorry.
100.
Excellent. Oh, thanks very much, Neil.
Okay, thank you very much.
Cheers.
Hope you enjoyed that interview with Neil. Wine ratings are a bit of a funny thing. I think Neil summed it up pretty well when he said that people are buying into a person's palate. I suppose if it's a bit like book critics. You take advice from a critic who you trust. The trouble is, a 100-point system seems to give a scientific impression that may not necessarily be there. I suppose ratings are a subjective thing, and if you have a palate that's in line with a critic, then you might as well trust their opinion and give things a go. We occasionally do experiments in our wine tastings that classify people into sort of normal, super, and non-tasters. The key thing here is the sensitivity, particularly to tannins in wine. Non-tasters hardly notice them, while super tasters are aware of it and normally don't like tannins at all. But by definition, a third are non, a third are normal, and a third are super. So if a critic is a non-taster or a super taster, they will at least taste wines different to two-thirds of the population. So I think it is important that you pick a critic that rates the wines the way you like them as well. Otherwise, you may be disappointed. Next week, we're going to be talking with Mike Ratcliffe from Warwick Estates in South Africa on grape varieties grown in South Africa, what works, what doesn't work, and what to keep an eye out for. So, until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.